Welcome to Double Jeopardy, the Law and Politics podcast with me, Ken MacDonald.
And with me, Tim Owen.
And on this episode, we're going to be considering the question of public corruption. It's traditionally been believed that the United Kingdom is not a corrupt country and is one of the cleaner countries. But that's perhaps been called more into question in recent years. And we're delighted to have with us as our guest to discuss this rather thorny topic, John Bowers, King's Counsel. John is an old friend of both me and Tim, but more relevantly for the purposes of this podcast, he is the author of a book which I think is going to be published on the 9th of May called Downward Spiral. And this is a book that looks at the state of public standards in public life in the UK in recent years. He seems to have had voluminous access to many figures, some of them quite establishment figures, and has drawn some very interesting conclusions, which no doubt we can go through. John attended grammar school and then comprehensive school in Grimsby. He got a scholarship to Lincoln College, Oxford, did the famous BCL, Bachelor of Civil Law degree, and was a lecturer at Lincoln and at St. Hugh's and at Christchurch for some years, called to the bar in 79, took silk in 98, and has practiced primarily in employment law and human rights. According to his website, he's been described in a review as, quote, an employment law rock star. So we can only hope that at some stage during the interview, he breaks into No Job Blues or some other such well-known blues song. He is and has been for some years principal of Brasenose College in Oxford. John, you're very welcome to Double Jeopardy.
Thank you very much for having me.
Hi, John. Great to see you again.
So, John, I'd like to start by asking you a little bit about your background. One other thing that your Chamber's website says is that your interests are football, changing the world, and promoting Grimsby. And I don't know whether they're necessarily placed in that order. But tell us a bit about your background, how you came to the law and how your legal career developed.
Well, my family finished up in Grimsby because my grandparents got a ticket from Poland to the US, but they were dropped off in Grimsby and they set up a shop there. And Grimsby is a very rough and tough town, very close relationships. Everybody seems to be each other's cousin or friend or second removed cousins. I still have a house in Grimsby, actually. I go up there as much as I can. I wasn't actually surprised by Brexit, given that very different approach. People feel left behind. They also feel levelling up hasn't achieved anything.
Well, John, what's your view of the Sacha Baron Cohen film Grimsby? Do you feel it does justice to your hometown?
Absolutely not. It wasn't even filmed in Grimsby.
It was filmed in Tilbury, I think.
Yeah. Although I think that's because the lads told Baron Cohen that he wouldn't be welcome on the docks.
What about the law? From Grimsby to Oxford and then from Oxford to the bar and then back to Oxford. What was it about the law that appealed to you?
Yeah, originally I wanted to use it as a stepping stone into politics, actually, but I became really interested in it, and to be paid for arguing was such a privilege. I was really interested in employment law. I started in collective labour law. People forget that in the 60s, more than half of the workforce were in trade unions, so it was a much bigger issue then.
Let's get to the book. I should say that it's notable for having been reviewed and very generously and well-reviewed in The New Statesman by Marina Wheeler, the distinguished barrister in her own right, but also the former wife of Boris Johnson, himself a former prime minister. And she was quite critical of Johnson in that review, and that created a bit of a news stir. But let's just start at the beginning. What was it that led you to think that a book of this type on this topic was necessary at this time?
Well, I'm particularly furious about the Priti Patel incident. She was found to have bullied civil servants at the Home Office in a systematic and orchestrated way. Yet instead of Johnson calling on her to resign, the government said they were, quotes, forming a square around the Pritzker, yeah, which is apparently a military term. The only person to resign, actually, was the independent advisor, Alex Allen. As I looked more into the independent advisor on ministerial interests, I realised it was a non-job, no enforcement power. So I started looking at the other ethical regulators.
But I know Alex Allen. In fact, I was DPP and on his selection committee when he was appointed permanent secretary at the end, then Department of Constitution Affairs under Charlie Faulkner. And he was an absolutely classic, straight up, straight down civil servant of the, I won't say old school, it makes him sound old fashioned, but a completely honourable, decent person. And the fact that someone like him was driven to resign by Johnson's behaviour speaks volumes, doesn't it?
Well, absolutely. And in fact, his successor, Lord Gyatt, finished up resigning. You know?
I mean, just for our listeners, of course, many of these episodes will be familiar to a greater or lesser extent. But of course, the Pritzker, the Priti Patel affair was by far from being the only example of this decline or corruption of public standards that you described. Do you want to just summarise briefly the litany of infamy which we've endured in recent years?
Bear in mind, John, we've only got 40 minutes or so.
Yeah, absolutely. I won't indulge too much. But so many of them begin with P. So you've got Patterson, who lobbied whilst an MP.
It's Owen Paterson.
Owen Paterson. He was close to Johnson because he was long-standing Brexiteer. The government sought to whip changes in the parliamentary standards system to retrospectively absolve him. You then have the whole party gate, which I think is what really resonated with the public, because they felt that during COVID there was one law for those who were making the rules and one law for the people subject to rules. And of course, Johnson eventually fell because of lies he told in relation to Chris Pincher, where he appointed him as deputy chief whip. And he suggested that he hadn't known that there had been allegations against him before. Yeah. There's also the felling, which has never happened before, of senior civil servants, a whole a range of permanent secretaries who were either encouraged to resign or not kept on when their fixed term ended.
I mean, there's so much there. We sort of bake this stuff in these days, as the Americans seem to have so much in the Trump era. But it, I mean, just stepping back, for a prime minister to be forced out of his office and essentially forced out of his parliament, out of parliament, as a result of having been found to lie to parliament, it's just a monumental event, isn't it?
Absolutely. And it's our system depends on the prime minister being the good chap or chapess who would glue the system together. And it also depends on a strong cabinet secretary. And it seems that Simon Case was chosen because he wouldn't speak truth to power. And that's why the whole system was corrupted. And that's what I wanted to chronicle in this book.
In the early chapters, you describe how the patchwork of codes and regulations and regulators reflects the historical development of the ethics regulation system in the UK. And you make the point that what happens is historically is that scandal will prompt institutional innovation in one area, while others are reformed incrementally, perhaps over decades. So you say the system's grown up in an unplanned way, but you say pragmatism is not the answer to the problem. You say this, I just wonder whether you think this may be, well, obviously you don't, but is this a bit of hyperbole? You say that the decline in standards puts the future of democracy and the very rule of law at risk? Discuss.
Well, I think a judge would say that probably is putting a bit high. But what I do think is important is that if trust in politicians and politics goes, it increasingly has, and respect for civil service and politicians goes down, then that in itself is a threat to democracy and indeed eventually to the rule of law. I think this is a really serious thing. I mean, you could say that overall the system righted itself, reasserted itself, but the informal system of conventions did. But it took a very long time, and it's many stages. It didn't look like it would do.
The question is whether the whole process has left weakness in its wake. I don't think it is hyperbole, actually. I think we have seen behavior that has been quite threatening to our constitutional arrangements. I mean, I'd pick out two things from the examples you give. One is the deliberate selection of people who are weak and placing them in positions of power so that Johnson and Cummings wouldn't be challenged. So I would argue, like you, that Simon Case comes into that category. But there are others. The defenestration of all the able people from the Tory centre so there was no one in the cabinet who would challenge Johnson. I mean, that's one side of it. The other thing that I think you're very strong on in your book is the treatment of senior civil servants. I mean, when I was DPP, my minister, if you like, it's not quite the same for the DPP, my minister was the Attorney General, and I had quite robust relationships with some of my Attorney Generals. But the idea that they would have treated me in the way that Priti Patel or other ministers seem to have treated their officials, or that my position would ever have been under threat for those reasons, was unthinkable. And I think unthinkable for all of my fellow permanent secretaries. I mean, we just weren't in that world. So we seem to be moving more towards the American system, which is, I think, something that Dominic Cummings wanted, that senior civil service appointments are political. And they're there to perform a political role and will change with administrations so that we'll have a continually politically shifting senior civil service. And that would be a major change in our constitutional arrangements, and I think a very bad one. I don't know what your view about that is.
Yeah, I think it would be dangerous because you'd have no institutional memory, for one thing. You would have people competing for jobs by taking increasingly extreme positions. So I think it would be disadvantageous.
Can we, before we go on to the concluding chapter where you set out in some detail going through all different areas of public life and the current sort of patchwork of regulators, and you come up with your recommendations, I think it's worth going back to say a few words about what perhaps is the last big review of standards in public life, which was the Nolan Report, which established the seven Nolan principles. I mean, do you want to just tell us briefly about the context for that and what they are?
Well, they're really quasi-constitutional standards that everyone in public life should aspire to. So they're contained in all sorts of codes, ministerial codes, cabinet manuals, non-departmental public body codes. There are seven. It's alleged that they were written on the back of a taxi by one of the Anthony King. It's probably apocryphal.
Oh, yes.
I hope
you mean in the back of a taxi, not on the back of a taxi.
Sorry, in the back of a taxi. So they had something to, on a fag packet, I suppose. So it's selflessness, that you should only act in the public interest, integrity, objectivity, so no bias, accountability, must submit themselves to scrutiny, which was something that was recognized in the breach rather than the observance throughout the Johnson years, openness and transparency, which there's very little in the lobbying area, for example, honesty, well, we won't dwell on that, and leadership. to their high-level statements of what we should aspire to. In a sense, they're like the overriding objective that we're used to in civil law. But, I mean, one of the issues is that we should get back to them. Probably there needs to be an eighth dealing with non-discrimination, but generally they're really very much fit for purpose.
And as you say, you describe them in the book as having quasi-constitutional status. Of course, the principles are not set out in any statute, either primary or secondary legislation. And as you say, they're a high-level statement of the overall direction in adhering to standards. I mean, just in terms of their justiciability, the answer at the moment is you wouldn't get very far in a judicial review citing these as binding principles of law, which a court could then assess the conduct of or decision making of ministers.
No, I mean they're aspirational rather than enforceable. I mean, it's interesting that enough attention has been drawn to it, I think, but the First Division Association, the Senior Civil Servants Trade Union, did take on the Cabinet Office over the Priti Patel incident.
Yeah.
They failed in their claim, but the judges did say that the ministerial code was justiciable. So there is some room for taking that further in the appropriate case.
I mean, this is interesting, isn't it? The legal status of rules, conventions, codes of conduct, and so on, and they're rather ambiguous legal status in the context of a state which has no written constitution. Yeah. And I guess I think this is one of the conclusions you draw. It's partly because we haven't got a written constitution that the legal ambiguity of these sorts of instruments is increasingly worrying in the context that we can no longer rely, it seems, on Peter Hennessy's famous formulation of the good chaps theory of government. In other words, we can be sure everything will work because they're all good chaps. Well, in recent years, we simply haven't been able to assume that because many of them seem to have been very bad chaps.
I think that puts emphasis on codifying some of the conventions, particularly around the position of the Prime Minister, because there's very little in legislation about that role. So the expectations and the role, I think, does need to be codified.
Can I just put you in your concluding chapter, having made that quote about the future of democracy and the rule of law being at risk? You say standards shouldn't be an optional afterthought. They should be central to public life, which, of course, I'm sure everyone agrees with. And you say we must try to stop the downward spiral. But you then say, for this, rules are necessary but not sufficient because it's as much about culture. And there are two interesting quotes. I just want to put these to you before we then talk about perhaps your specific recommendations. You quote Dame Julie Mellor, who was the Parliamentary and Health Service Ombudsman, where she said, penalties are not the heart of the issue. Sanctions on their own make people nervous and risk-averse and do not create the best long-term solutions which change the system to facilitate the right behaviour and inhibit the worst behaviour. So that tends to suggest that strict law isn't necessarily the answer. You then quote Daniel Greenberg, who was an experienced parliamentary counsel and is now the Parliamentary Commissioner for Standards. And he just says this: you can take a horse to the ethical water, but you cannot make it drink. You can make it more difficult for a horse not to drink by articulating statutory ethical criteria that it must consider. But that drags judges further into the policing of ethics than they want to go, because it leads to them being forced to adjudicate on the application of necessarily open criteria in a context about which they know less than the regulator. So those two quotes, if you like, suggest that more rules and rules which require judicial supervision isn't necessarily a good idea. Well, what's your view about that?
Yeah. I mean, I respect very much Julie Mellor, who was parliamentary ombudsman for many years, and Daniel Greenberg position. And I think that there are different areas. There are certain ones that the courts should not be involved in, which are political. On the other hand, I see no reason why appointments shouldn't be judicialized. If somebody is failing to take the advice of the Committee on Business Appointments because there's a conflict of interest, there's been no reason why you shouldn't get an injunction on the same way as you do if there's a restrictive covenant disobeyed. Similarly, in relation to some of the public appointments farragos that we've had on, for example, Richard Sharp being appointed as chairman of the BBC, I don't see why that shouldn't be judicialised.
Sorry to interrupt you, that's because whether or not you're in breach of the rules about business appointments after you leave government, whether you're a minister or a civil servant, is a sort of more hard-edged issue.
Yeah, and I mean, what's a real disgrace, and actually people who were, Ken might say, quite establishment, told me off the record about the complete disgrace that there is of Ministry of Defence officials going into defence procurement companies, of which, of course, there are very few. So it's a real revolving door. I don't see why that shouldn't be made enforceable. But yeah, I agree, the more soft edge things which relate to the ministerial code essentially are political matters that have to be for the Prime Minister. But the Prime Minister shouldn't be initiator, judge and jury of the complaints, and also decide whether things should be inquired into at all.
Well, that's obviously right. You come to some quite hard-edged conclusions about ACABA, about the organisations that's supposed to control the extent to which former ministers can go through the revolving door into organisations with which they had relationships in ministerial positions. And that is an absolute disgrace, actually. And you're right, particularly to highlight defence. That's been going on for years. It was going on during my time. And it's because the number of companies is so small and the wealth flowing into them from the state is so vast that it's particularly scandalous. I think one of your conclusions is that ACABA should be strengthened. It should no longer be an advisory council. It should be a directing council, and there should be strict rules. And that's obviously right. But this is a wider question, isn't it, about lobbying? I mean, we've already mentioned one case, but there's also the Greensill case involving the former Prime Minister, now Foreign Secretary, David Cameron. I mean, the lobbying in Westminster, I can tell you from my own experience and from gossip that one picks up, is the absolute Wild West. And the extent to which lobbying is taking place, you know, beneath the public gaze and beneath parliamentary gaze, I think is quite shocking.
Well, and of course it was David Cameron who made a speech when he was leader of the opposition saying that lobbying is the next scandal waiting to happen. I don't suppose he thought it would be him who would be at the centre of it. But I mean, what's particularly interesting in my mind about Greensill, which was about incessant lobbying for the Greensill Bank to have benefits under the COVID system, and the fact that Greensill himself was brought into the heart of government, even though he had a conflict of interest.
This was lobbying by David Cameron once he had ceased to be Prime Minister, constantly emailing, WhatsApping, phoning ministers on Greensill's behalf.
And he'd been brought into government, had Greensill, by the former cabinet secretary, the late Sir Jeremy Hayward.
Absolutely. But what's interesting is that David Cameron was right in saying that no rules were broken. Hard-edged rules were broken. The registrar of consultant lobbyists on a generous view covers about 10% of the lobbying industry because there are all sorts of exclusions. Cameron was excluded because he was a contractor of Greensill rather than an independent lobbyist.
So, well, that's the whole. That's the whole point, John, and the theme of so much of your book that they're simply. I mean, no one wants to live in a society which is utterly rule bound, but here there's simply insufficient regulation, and you know it's again partly on the basis that we believe that good chaps don't behave like that. Yeah, but David Cameron, who was generally thought by many people to be a good chap, did behave like that.
Yeah, he did, and he apologised for it.
Yeah.
There was a report, wasn't there, commissioned into that episode? I think the former senior partner at Slaughter & May.
Nigel Boardman. Yeah.
Sir Nigel Boardman. Just to remind us what the conclusion of that report was.
Well, he said that generally lobbying was a good thing. I think it was lobbied by the lobbyists. And of course, the big law firms do take a part in that. But he did come up with some useful material, in particular that ministers should be bound by the business appointment rules. But I think we need a much wider approach to this. I think there should be a ban on lobbying by ex-ministers for 5 years. I think after 5 years, probably their currency in terms of influence and confidential information goes. And that should be enforceable.
I just wanted to ask one question which is peculiar to lawyers, because it has always troubled me, and we've touched on this in the past on the podcast. I mean, I was Director of Public Prosecutions for 5 years, and then I stopped being DPP and went back to Chambers, and I didn't do any CPS work, obviously. But, I mean, it's quite likely that some people briefed me when I returned to Chambers because I'd been DPP, or some people wanted my advice on a piece of work so they could wave it around and say, this is what a former DPP thinks. I mean, I'm sort of arguing against my own living here in a sense, but do you think that's problematic?
I don't really. I would have thought people wanted you because you're Ken McDonald, but
a very naive view, John.
A very generous view. Thank you, John. Actually, I shouldn't have asked that question because you might have accused me of a sort of gross misconduct and disgraceful behaviour, and then we'd have had to have edited that from the podcast.
Let's just turn to your conclusions or recommendations. They sort of really cover eight areas. I'll just briefly summarise them, and then perhaps we can just look at some of them in more detail. So firstly, you look at Parliament and the Cabinet. You say there's a need to tackle increasing weakness of Parliament and then the long-term decline in Cabinet government, a new arrangement, an overarching system, a new commitment to restore Nolan ethics, you say. Secondly, you deal with conventions and the written constitution. You say we need a soft codification, but that a written constitution is not achievable. Thirdly, you say the various ethical bodies should all be placed on a firm statutory footing so we have an ethical constitution. Fourthly, you say there should be a greater role for judicial review as the best defence against elective dictatorship. Fifthly, you refer, I want to come back to this, you say the best and the brightest people no longer enter public life, whether it's politics or the civil service, and there's a feeling of mediocrity and mendacity about those who rise to the top. You then deal with lobbying, and you emphasise there needs to be complete transparency on lobbying and a register of all activities. Every discussion between a minister and a lobbyist should be recorded, and real sanctions should be imposed. Seventhly, you deal with the Prime Minister's office and the need, for example, for the Prime Minister to be under a duty to give a detailed written determination justifying why he or she refuses to accept a decision of the independent advisor or minister's interests. And then finally, you talk about buttressing the ministerial code. Ministers should swear an oath to abide by it, and it should have a legal basis. So, I mean, I think that covers your recommendations.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's obviously a pretty long shopping list. Can I just go back to one, and may ask other things, but this thing about the best and the brightest no longer entering. You refer to the huge pay gap, the need to boost public sector rewards. I mean, just by way of example, and obviously Singapore is not like the United Kingdom in many ways, but the Chief Justice of Singapore, he earns 564,000 Singapore dollars. That's his salary, which is £330,000. And all judges in Singapore earn huge amounts of money compared to the UK. So that's one example. And the Prime Minister of Singapore earns 2,200,000 Singapore dollars. That's 1.3 million pounds. So you're dealing there with a country that, in order to attract the best and the brightest, pays them huge amounts of money compared, for example, to what we pay. I mean, do you think that is the answer? I mean, it's only one approach, but I mean, it does seem pretty obvious that lots of talented people are deterred from entering public
life. Before you answer, John, I think I've spoken to people in the Singapore government about this. The rationale, they say, for their policy is not so much to attract the brightest and the best, but to avoid corruption.
Yeah. Mm. Well, the two go together, perhaps.
Interesting.
I guess maybe they do.
Interesting. I mean, I think I'm right in saying that civil servants in Singapore are much better paid.
Yeah. They are.
Than
yeah. They are.
We do. I mean, I just know, and I'm not saying that necessarily the best and the brightest students are at Raised nose, but many of them are. I just know that so few of them are looking at the civil service, even less actually about going into politics. Of course, they may change later on. I think that is a real potential decline. I think also, and I do cover this in the book as well, that the fact that the government keeps talking about the civil service as the blob, as though it's some hostile creature, doesn't help. So it's not just money, it's some morale as well. But I mean, just looking at the ethical regulators, I mean, we're doing all of this on the cheap. We were talking about the Advisory Committee on Business Appointments. I think they have 2.5 staff. I mean, they just can't investigate what people are doing. I mean, many people say that Private Eye knows more about later business appointments than ACABA does.
I mean, when I was doing an equivalent job to yours at another college with a decidedly left-wing student body, perhaps a bit unlike yours, I noticed the same thing. I mean, there were some who would be going into the civil service, but very few. I think we recently had a young graduate who became a Labour MP, but very few wanted to go into politics. It's partly, it's clearly not the money. It's that there's this sort of popular sense now of contempt for politicians and people in public service, that they're all venal, they're all in it for themselves, they're some sort of shadowy elite. And it's a phenomenon that I think exists across the Western world and is worsening. And that's very dangerous, because it does mean that people don't view it as an attractive career. I mean, if you think of the past, you mentioned some of these figures in your book, John, you know, the Tony Crosslands, the Dennis Healy's, the sort of great, the Nye Bevins, the Herbert Morrison's, the great, fantastically substantial figures of the past. These sorts of people don't go into politics anymore, and that's a constitutional problem, isn't it?
Yeah, I think it is. I mean, we shouldn't be completely nostalgic for a previous time.
Yeah.
Everybody was selfless, and of course, I think having 24-hour media intrusion means that people are taken off their perch, whereas people like Tony Crossland, who was actually MP for Grimsby, as it happened, were able to keep a very interesting private life private. But having said all that, and I mean, I agree with you, it's not just the money, Ken, but I think money does indicate the place that society puts on people as well.
Can I ask you a question? And again, you refer to this in the book, that some people say, look, you know, there's always been this sort of corruption.
Yeah.
Lloyd George, the Welsh wizard, was a famous example. People have always behaved like this. There have always been wrong-ins. And all that's really different now is that we have a more intrusive media, we have social media, there's more transparency, and more of it rises to the surface. So that what you're describing is really our better knowledge of something that's always been going on. And so your analysis is really alarmist. I mean, how do you respond to that?
Well, I mean, I can understand that view, but I'd make 2 points. I really don't think that we've had corruption in the sense that we have now since Lloyd George. So that was a one-off. And secondly, during the Johnson period and the Truss period, there was a sort of flouting of the rules and a flaunting of the flouting, which I think
that was new
for Lloyd George. I mean, actually, the first Prime Minister, Robert Walpole, was probably the most corrupt of the lot. But besides those two, I just don't think we've seen anything like this. Plus, of course, the effect, and we probably haven't got time to talk about this in detail, the effect of populism. The idea that we have no truck or even contempt for experts is another feature, I think, of this.
Well, I mean, in the beginning of your book, you identify sort of four separate causes you try and identify of this decline. And one is, you say, the modern political career trajectories. In other words, a whole raft of people who've never had any other job other than being in politics. Secondly, you identify populist politics, the sort of Brexit effect and Trumpian style politics. Thirdly, you refer to the binary electoral system, which means, you know, there's very little prospect of fundamental change. And then, and fourthly, the quality of people who go into public life. But can I just put you, while you were writing your book, the UK Governance Project, this commission that was chaired by Dominic Grieve and included a number of illustrious figures, including former President of the Supreme Court, Lloyd Neuberger, and Sir Jonathan Jones, who's been on the podcast, Dame Margaret Hodge, and others. They look at the same problem as you, but it looks like they believe a more modest changes are possible. They say at the beginning, in carrying out this review and coming up with our recommendations, this commission believes that much can be done to restore public confidence by relatively small changes that are easily deliverable. I get the impression that's not your view.
Yeah, I mean, I've obviously got massive respect for all the people on that committee, and it did produce some really interesting results. But I think they were quite keen to avoid legislation. I don't take that view. I think it is important to get these bodies on a statutory basis so that they can't be abolished. It did look at one time as though Johnson was going to abolish the independent advisor on ministerial interests. I think that should be made difficult, which putting it in statutory form would. But, you know, I accept there's no silver bullet. I think there is also the point that some of these issues have been investigated by many different people. Greenslaw was investigated by four different bodies. I would have thought you'd have a more rational system. In Greensill, all of the bodies cohered. On number 10 refurbishment, you had the independent advisor accepting Johnson's word, and then the Electoral Commission finding that he was in breach of the rules. So you did have opposite conclusions there. So I think this is a time, particularly with a likely new government, for looking at the system in a holistic way, which hasn't been done since Nolan.
Well, anyone accepting Johnson's word is a brave person. But can I just, before we finish, I just wanted to ask you this, and I'm not asking to make a party political point at all, but to what extent do you think some of this may have been the result of the upheavals of Brexit, whatever you think of Brexit, and the particular personality of Johnson himself? And to what extent, and again, I'm not asking you to make a party political point, but to what extent do you think things may change and improve if we have a new administration sometime later this year.
With Sue Gray as the chief of staff to the Prime Minister.
Which is quite a significant point. I think the toxicity in the body politic has certainly increased because of the Brexit fissure, that there's been very little idea of bringing people together. It's always been trying to outflank each other. And I think there is a case for saying that Johnson, not as a party political issue, but just in terms of his flouting of the rules, was a one-off, although Truss came pretty close. And Sunak, although I think he's a pretty straight kind of guy, as Tony Blair
to quote a phrase.
I think he's made some serious misjudgments in appointing some of the people he has and standing by them, Richard Sharp, Sir Harvey, Gavin Williamson, and to name...
Suella Braverman.
To name a few. But no, I agree with you. I think a lot of it can be traced back to that.
And the second part of my question, if there's a new administration?
Oh, sorry, new administration. Well, I mean, certainly Keir Starmer, having held your position, and Ken, I think, is... clearly a person of integrity. I very much doubt whether we're going to have parties at number 10 during a lockdown. But I think the real issue is whether there's the political will to tackle these issues, because I can well understand, as Prime Minister, you'd probably want to keep everything quite close to you.
John, it's been a great discussion. The name of the book is Downward Spiral. It will be available, I think, as Ken said, in all good bookshops from, is it the 9th of May?
I think it's earlier than that. I think it's from next week. But put your orders in now, all good bookshops.
Yeah, well, it's a very good read, and it certainly gives plenty for the next government to think about, and provides a sort of blueprint for the kind of reform that I certainly agree is necessary if standards in public life are actually going to be improved.
Yeah, and I hope that Keir Starmer and his senior people will read it. I certainly recommend it to everyone. Thank you very much for being with us today, John.
Thank you very much for having me.
Thank you, John. You've been listening to Double Jeopardy, the Law and Politics podcast, with Ken MacDonald and with me, Tim Owen. If you've enjoyed this episode, have a look at our back catalogue. There's plenty there to listen to, much of it not particularly time sensitive. So have a browse at that. And if you feel inclined to give us a review, hopefully a good one, then please do so. It helps others to find us and boosts us up the ratings. We have a 5-star rating on Spotify and a 5-star rating on Apple. So please spread the word. Our editor is Billy Lawrence, and our social media advisor is Jess Jones. We will see you soon.